Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
My name is Dave Hanratty, and there will be no encore. Welcome back to the podcast. It's Adam Shanahan.
It is. It's me and you.
Yeah, it is. We were supposed to have a guest, but unfortunately they could not make it due to a last-minute snafu. They send their apologies and will return at a certain point down the line. But for now, it's just me and you.
Because it is.
I figured, there's no point in just not doing an episode.
Yeah, and we were both, we're both able-bodied men.
Sure,
ready to take on the latest top five topic?
To some degree, yeah.
That topic is, Dave.
Top five bizarre music controversies, or if you're from another part of the world, which I sometimes say, controversies.
Controversies.
Yeah, I don't know. Envelope, whatever. Yeah. It's fine, you can pronounce things differently. Bizarre music controversies, as it sounds. Controversies in music, though, were a bit eyebrow-raising, a bit strange, perhaps, a bit like, really? Okay, fine.
Yeah, that captured the zeitgeist as well.
So we have a top five. It is just five. Usually the top five is actually secretly 10, but this time it's five, because it's me and Adam combined.
Yep.
So, mostly me, but...
Yeah.
No, it's not a dig. It's because recently...
In a role reversal,
literally last week, it was mostly you. So, it's...
It's all about balance here on No Encore, everybody.
It is, yeah. It's all about balance. And if you want to apply some balance to this, to our bank balance...
You want to increase our balance.
Yeah, that's probably better. It's patreon.com/No Encore if you want to support the show. €5, I guess, but, you can pay more if you want to. Thank you to everyone that does. It will give you the show a day early. You'll get a day early in your feed on Patreon, 24 hours early on Thursday, and also we'll take the ads off for you as well.
So. If you're so inclined and you're not a fan, the ads help us keep the lights on here. But
they actually do. Although the lights nicely dimmed this week.
We do indeed.
In the studio. There's some Christmas lights. So to get us to be able to see each other again. Anyway, listen, we'll move off this real quick, but it's patreon.com/No Encore if you want to support the show. Speaking of support, it's time for the news section.
Start spreading the news.
And the news will be spread, and this is how it works. Last week on the show, we spoke about Irish Women in Harmony on The Late Late Show. They basically, if you missed that episode, they basically were not allowed to express support visibly for Palestine, for people in Palestine and Gaza, as it is under a horrific military attack. As we all know, a genocide is occurring over there, and we talked about that last week. And RTE's response to that and the Irish Women in Harmony's response to that as well. Go back last week to the episode if you want to hear how that played out. But the reason we're bringing it up again is there hasn't, not that I've seen, I haven't seen an update from the collective of the Irish Women in Harmony at all. But the story is still somehow relevant because, this podcast comes out on a Friday. We wait and see what happens over the weekend. Late Late Show takes place on a Friday. Kneecap were on last Friday. Who are they?
Kneecap are a rap trio, I suppose, from Belfast. They are very much Irish speakers, very much big supporters of the Irish language. A lot of their music is and lyrics are in Irish. They are very I would say it's probably safe to say they're quite politically active.
Yeah.
In Ireland, and of course abroad as well. The issue that we're going to, discuss in regards to Kneecap is the same one that Irish Women in Harmony faced up against, essentially, with RTE and the kind of censorship around.
But it went different this time.
Yeah, around Gaza, yeah.
Yeah, they're on the Late Late Show last week because they're very much in the ascendancy. They've been around for a few years now. They're a band that kind of started as a joke, but they very much... you know, gone from strength
to
strength.
They've flipped the script on it a little bit, haven't they?
Yeah, which they've every right to do. I mean, I did a podcast about them recently for the Belfast Telegraph, and I enjoyed chatting about them. But they have got a film called Kneecap, which Michael Fassbender's in.
Yeah.
And it played over at the Sundance Film Festival, won the Audience Award in the States. And so they're big business right now, but they're not, you know, they're with the increasing, I suppose, views on their platform, they're using that platform. So last Friday, this following audio is from them sitting down in the studio at RTE with Patrick Keelty. And one of them had changed into a football jersey of Palestinian origin.
Yeah.
And here's how that went down.
DJ Provy here. You've done a bit of a costume change here.
Yes.
There you go. Now, I have to say, you know, I'm obliged to say this, that our thoughts are with everybody in that conflict. Some horrific stuff is happening there. I'm also obliged to say that in the politics, there's another side of it, and some people mightn't agree with what you've done. So,
100%, but that's why we're here, and we use our platform to highlight the genocide that's happening in Palestine at the moment. 30,000. Palestinians have been murdered by American weapons, and mostly 2/3 of them, women and children. So I think we just have to, that's why we feel, use this platform as an opportunity to appeal to Irish people to attend rallies and protests and to support the BDS movement, to show solidarity to Palestine, and hopefully one day the Palestine will be free.
Now, perfectly reasonable sentiment, I would have thought.
Yep.
And if anyone's going to get mad about Patrick Keelty, what he said there, I think he has to do that in his job as neutral host of a talk show on the national broadcaster.
Yeah, there's someone in his ear literally telling him to say that as well.
On the fly, as it happened. Yeah. And I got to say, I think he did a good job. But you might be wondering, you might be like, well, how come this was allowed and the Irish Women in Harmony weren't? That is not the case. A statement released to the Journal the following day, an RTÉ spokesperson said that Kneecap's manager had stated that the performers intended to wear badges showing support for Palestine, but the show's producers told them that it wasn't allowed and the performance would have to be cancelled because they did perform as well. They said the band agreed not to wear the badges for the live performance. However, during the performance and the subsequent interview, they chose not to comply with that agreement. They put badges on and revealed that one band member was wearing a Palestinian football jersey. So there you go. Civil disobedience in this case.
Yeah, and I mean, if you were one of the producers on The Late Late and you invited Kneecap on, you cannot expect him to not do that.
Yeah.
I think it's like everyone knew it was going to happen. I there's no doubt in my mind that everybody knew it was going to happen, from Patrick Keelty to Kneecap themselves, of course, to the RTÉ producers. This is an ass covering exercise, 100%. Like, no doubt in my mind. They were always, like, they're so politically active. They've been so vocal about this since the start. There's no way they weren't going to do something, especially give, and like, I think probably, you know, the gasoline was poured on the fire, so to speak, in regards to, you know, their desire and need to do this based on what happened last week.
Whose desire?
Kneecap's.
Okay. Not RTÉ's desire.
No, not at all. Like, I think there's the cynical part of me almost thinks that, like, the producers and people who are booking Kneecap on probably knew what they were doing a little bit there.
I mean, it could have been arranged weeks in advance.
But see, this is the thing. It wasn't, and like, again, it's not announced until the week of course.
Yeah.
So we have no real way of knowing that. But like I said, that's just the cynical part of me.
I doubt it was a case of, okay, we need to break glass here in case of emergency and get these guys on to do something, you know, rebellious. I think it's just a timing thing. I think it's a weird coincidence, perhaps. I mean, the booking was probably made some time ago. Mm. So a spokesperson said that in live television. Also, I should at this point apologise on our behalf, because both myself and Adam are slightly under the weather.
We are sick. I said we were able-bodied men.
I've been sick since fucking December, and it's taking a while to clear my system. I think I'm okay, everyone, but I know I, you know, coughing and whatever. Let me, you know, allow me.
Allow us, listeners. Thank you so much.
Spokesperson for RTÉ said that in live television, there's always a risk of quote-unquote unplanned programming. A team of editorial professionals that work in the show proceeded to act in full compliance with RTÉ's guidelines, adapted filming, and took action, whereby Keelty provided the context and balance to the discussion at the Kneecap, as you heard there. But like, the interview continued, you know, like, they were there out there for like 13 minutes in full. And I will say as well, like, you know, I pulled that clip from their YouTube. They didn't cut that section. at least. You know, there hasn't been an active post-censorship here.
Yeah, yeah, and I would have expected that probably from, like, on the RT player, or even, like, obviously the social clips on the RT side, we're never going to include that, but it was, you know, it wasn't... I mean, in RT's credit, they didn't take it out.
You know, whether it goes out in the official accounts or not, doesn't matter. I mean, a lot of people like filmed it off their phones, on their TVs and whatever. I've uploaded it independently. The band themselves have shared it. They did the right thing as far as I'm concerned. And again, as you say, like, this would be like inviting Rage Against the Machine onto your show and be like, and by the way, don't mention...
Yeah, don't bring politics into it.
Yeah, just, you know, just give us the songs, please. Now, I will say, as a byproduct of this, though, and a perhaps unfortunate one, because I have been thinking about last week's discussion, and, you know, like, it's... Part of me thinks, oh, I didn't go hard enough, or I was too harsh, or whatever. It's more like, you know, I think that there's an unfortunate byproduct here in as much as this is hardly the big takeaway that it should be, but it's an element. It doesn't make the whole Irish Women in Harmony situation to go on and play look great now.
No.
In the immediacy of it, like the very next musical act, who are also men, you know, like, I mean, like, you don't want to turn this into a man-woman thing, but, like, you know, it adds... kind of salt into the wound or something, not unintentionally. Like, it's hardly Kneecap's intention to do that. But it just, it doesn't, if you stack the two incidents up together coming on one show after the other, it doesn't look great.
Yeah, and I think we're probably down to, that's down to what you said about it just being maybe, like, fortunate slash unfortunate time in whatever way you want to frame it. Like, I think we've kind of discussed at length that, with last week, you know, that... It's such a difficult situation. I thought that you and Zara had a really good discussion on it last week. So if anyone hasn't actually listened to that, go back and listen to it next week. Personally, I think the wrong thing to do was to continue playing anyway. But that's my, like I said, that's my personal opinion. I'm not holding like any grudges against anybody who was involved, and I think the fact that I encourage that whatsoever. The fucking, you know, pitchfork torch wielding online heads, like, it's very frustrating seeing that. When the hand was probably forced at the last minute.
Just to reiterate, I think the Irish Women in Harmony were put into an extremely difficult position.
So difficult, yeah.
We don't know the exact time scale on there, you know, how much time was there to make a decision, commitments were made, etc. I'm not looking to demonise anyone in that group. I'm sure there are individual regrets. It's a lot of different people, you know. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's just a trio, and they're a more politically minded trio. And as you say, like, I mean, it would be very off-brand for Kneecap to not... Like, that's their gut reaction. Mm-hmm. Irish Women in Harmony, it's a different thing. It's a nascent group, and it exists for different reasons. And it's, you know, like, it's not fair. I don't think, like I don't think anyone in that group should be individualized and called anything derogatory. But I just think that, you know, like I say, it's an unfortunate, you know, like, side by side.
Yeah, and what I will say as well is I think that, like, the whole thing about Kneecap is, like, the group itself is inherently political. Like, that's built into the DNA of Kneecap. I don't necessarily think that's built into the DNA of Irish Women in Harmony. I don't think that's passing, you know, negative comment on the group. I just don't think that they would consider themselves, like, primarily, you know, politically engaged.
No, and they're absolutely not. Like that's not why it exists. It's an entirely different thing. But like I say, I just thought it was, you know, it was an unavoidable contrast. And, yeah, you know, we'll see what happens now. Like, I mean, like, does the next musician on, you know, how is this going to continue?
Personally, I think it should continue. I think, like, what are they going to do? Just stop booking musical guests then if, like, no one is complying? Like, could a boycott work? I don't know.
I mean, as you say, it's civil disobedience.
Yeah, and, like, to be fair, like, a couple of things to take away as well is it was incredibly, it was Mowgli Bapa, who we heard speaking there in the clip, and he spoke so well. I thought he just held his nerve. In fairness to Patrick Keelty, let him finish his point, didn't cut him off.
Yeah, he moved it on after in a very kind of, you know, like, I want to go back to the music, you know, now, which is fine.
Yeah,
like, but I mean, like, and there you go. It's a frank, you know, polite is probably the wrong word, but it's a civil and a fucking, you know, eloquent and a thoughtful way of putting it across. And there was, you know, it wasn't like they were fucking ripping the seats up or anything.
Not at all.
And that's something I said in the podcast, the one I did about them a while ago. I was like, these are very intelligent guys. You know, I wouldn't want to get into a row with them because I think I'd fucking lose. You know, like they're very fucking clever.
And one thing the last thing I will say on it is, I think it's the reaction is a really good temperature gauge on how people are feeling about the situation in society as a whole.
You hear people cheering in the studio.
People cheering. See, this is the thing.
Would like, not happen in the 90s. You know,
like, absolutely not. And like, realistically.
The glorious Pat Kenny days. You know,
or the Gay Byrne days, if we go back further.
Stop that.
But even
it's getting worse. My impression's getting worse. Sorry.
We all know. We all know who it is.
A great man.
He's in there. He's just waiting to escape.
The broadcaster.
Yeah. Broadcaster of note.
His spirit's in all of us. You know?
But so the thing about it was like I think it was a really good temperature check, first of all, for the audience to like see who the late viewership clearly with the people in the studio. And again, these are lotteries that are done a long time in advance, so they wouldn't have known that Kneecap were going to be on there. So this is a random selection of people.
I'm often out at Arena, like in the radio studio on a Friday, doing album reviews and stuff, and I'll walk by as they're queuing up to go in for their big night.
Nice.
And I'm always just like, will I just join the queue?
Where's Dave? He's in the studio waiting for you. I think it's a really good temperature check. I think the reaction has been, like, I haven't seen, there's probably going to be a negative reaction somewhere. I'd love to know how many complaints?
I think it was two, I believe.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Like, there
was reportage today. I believe the number was two.
Two.
May have gone up since then, but the report I saw was two complaints.
Like,
it's a different generation.
I don't know. Like, I think that says all we need to say on it.
Yeah, that's fine. Also, sorry, was that rain?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
On the roof?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was like, what is that?
No, it started to really come down there. It's a hell of a... If you heard a little bit of tip-tapping.
That's my favourite sound in the world. But, you know, there are other Irish musicians to talk about.
Yes, like who, Dave?
Shane Lynch. Former Boyzone legend.
Boyzone star of record.
Shane Lynch.
Shane Lynch. I'm going to say that about everybody today now.
Bad boy of Boyzone.
Yeah.
You could say.
Yeah. I think he was. I think that's pretty.
That was his
thing. Yeah.
That was his brand. He has made an outlandish claim, which actually follows on from other claims he made recently. He was speaking to the Sunday World this week, and he says that Taylor Swift, there it is again, can't stop talking about her.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift is apparently, according to Shane Lynch, performing satanic rituals.
Because of course she is.
In front of millions of fans.
There's only one way you can sell that many tickets. It's by summoning the devil to your aid.
The committed Christian, it says here, that being Shane Lynch, says some music is a danger to society because artists are channeling the devil in plain sight. He aired his views as he and his wife Sheena, who's a star of The Real Housewives of Cheshire. Do you watch that?
I don't.
Sounds like you're missing out.
I don't watch any of The Real Housewives. As far as a reality show goes, I believe it's very enjoyable.
My brother's a fan of some of them. I don't think he goes as far as regional UK. But launched their latest business venture, blah, 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 blah. So he first shared his views on Satanism in the music industry last year on a premier Christian radio podcast. He claimed Sam Smith and Beyonce are, quote, so demonic it's unbelievable. He said that in his time in the industry, he'd witnessed satanic rituals where albums were prayed over to ensure success. And he told the Sunday World that Taylor Swift is an advocate of Satanism. He says, and I quote, I think when you're looking at a lot of artists out there, a lot of their stage shows are satanic rituals live in front of 20,000 people without them realizing and recognizing. You'll see a lot of hoods up and masks on and fire ceremonies.
Fire ceremonies, pyrotechnics.
Is he going to Slipknot games?
It's pyrotechnics. Is he at Rammstein? And Taylor Swift's co-headliner.
Even down to Taylor Swift, he says, one of the biggest artists in the world. You watch one of her shows and she has two or three demonic rituals to do with the pentagrams on the ground.
Oh, get lost.
To do with all sorts of stuff on stage. But to a lot of people, it's just art and that's how they're seeing it.
Sorry, before we move on, I just think the quote of like him claiming Sam Smith and Beyonce are so demonic, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's... That's a quote and a half. Like,
Sam Smith has definitely attracted people for that because, you know, like the imagery and they're like, it's banned the sick filth, you know, the children, all that kind of bullshit. So Shane Lynch also says, even the beats of music can have an impact on people. That's true. I mean, as a general statement, that's true.
As a general statement,
but
yes.
But get this, he stopped listening to hip hop and grime for these very reasons. He says, sometimes music are damaging society. And children in particular. He says, when it comes to a lot of the music at the moment, more on the hip-hop side, a lot of satanic, a lot of evil, including down to the beats. It's very real. Music attaches to your emotions. It has a connection to your spirit and how you feel. And that's why I've stopped listening to those types of music, because it doesn't suit my spirit. It 100% has an effect on society. I think our society has never been worse in many areas, and it starts from our children.
Yeah, this is like... To refer immediately to the imagery of this episode, mm-hmm. It's so Helen Lovejoy, isn't it?
Like, although it does say here, the hands-on dad, good writing, doesn't police what his daughters listen to. They love music, he says. I don't try and stop them. They have to learn for themselves. I will encourage and explain to them, music is dangerous. I want to remind everyone that Shane Lynch made his money in the music industry for many, many years.
Yeah, exactly.
But like a willing participant.
I wouldn't say that Boyzone's lyrical content or songwriting was hedonistic by any means, but like, you know.
Play it backwards.
Yeah, and do a couple of fire rituals. I'm sure there's pyrotechnics at those gigs. Wonder what he thought of that.
Yeah, like that's, they weren't playing just in front of like a...
Not trying, like again, I'm not trying to belittle religion. Like if this is his belief system, that's fine. But like, it sounds a bit ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it's extreme. It's an extreme take that I don't agree with, and fair play to him.
It's a bizarre music controversy, perhaps, Dave.
Maybe, yeah. Speaking of holograms, how do you feel about those?
I can tell you Shane Lynch probably wouldn't be happy with it.
No, that would be...
I don't mind them.
That would be an apparition.
Yeah.
You know, coming exactly. after him. But there's talk of a hologram show of Freddie Mercury, which
I'm so surprised this hasn't happened sooner.
I think it did in the sense that there was like a test or something, or there was like a quick cameo of something. They've used other way. An optical illusion, it says here, of the frontman was shown during Queen's Rhapsody tour. That really would freak out Shane Lynch. But yeah, and the illusion, by the way, brought Brian May to tears during the show.
That's nice.
Is it?
I think so.
I don't know.
Unless it was like tears being like, I can't believe he's back. and I'm not in the line. I'm not the head honcho anymore.
It's like when Daniel Day-Lewis, apparently he was performing as Hamlet on the stage and he saw the ghost of his father and then never performed the play again, or some kind of legendary theatre story.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we need holograms of Freddie Mercury, but I guess people like the ABBA thing.
Yeah, well, that's with the size of the tour and the success of the tour, it seems to be, you know, I could see why other bands with members who may have passed, or bands who are, you know, in the Kiss realm, not to get into the Kiss corner, but like they're all just kind of finished now, you know, they're at that age where touring is probably physically very demanding. It makes sense for commercial viability of the business, which is the band,
to
do it.
But someone very important here doesn't have a say in any of this. And when he died, Freddie Mercury probably didn't have holograms on his mind, you know?
Probably not.
I think it's one thing for Gene Simmons to be like, listen, guys, we're signing this mega deal while we're alive and we're going to have money for the rest of our generation.
It is different.
And so are children's children, et cetera, et cetera. It's another thing when it's Tupac. It's another thing when it's Freddie Mercury and someone out there is being like, yeah, grand, cool. Like, I don't like it. It's like putting, you know, like the thing about actors and movies and stuff where it's like, I don't like it. I don't like it.
Yeah. You would assume it has the blessing of his family.
Well.
But we don't know that. And you would like to think that it does. But we know what Brian May is like as
well.
We
do, yeah.
So chances are this is one of his crackpot schemes.
Another great man. A bit more tangible, but no less corporeal. It's talk of a statue for Lemmy of Motorhead.
Yeah, give it to him.
Really?
Yeah, why not?
Why? Why do it?
He is like, so you think of Lemmy, you know exactly what he looks like.
Exactly, so he doesn't need a statue.
I think that's exactly why he doesn't need a statue.
The 2.2-meter statue will be erected in the marketplace of Burslem, the town where Lemmy was born before his family moved to Newcastle under Lyme. It's not the only statue, though, if this one does get the go-ahead, because in 2016 there was another one erected at the Rainbow Bar and Grill in Los Angeles, and there's also a statue of him at Germany's Wacken Air Open Festival.
Great.
Yeah.
The more the merrier. I think it's good, like, because it's not a massive place where he's from, is it? Like, so, you know, it's nice to just have a little, it's nice that his, you know, his hometown or the place that he's from is paying homage to his successes. Albeit posthumously, but even still, I think it's a nice thing. It's a nice gesture from the town, I think.
I don't know. I'm conflicted on these things because they never look great. You know, the Luke Kelly.
Oh no, they don't. No, they look terrible.
The Luke Kelly statues are pretty terrible.
It's the gesture that means more than anything. I think the form, you know, is probably going to want for, you know, something.
Have you ever seen, like, there's a RoboCop statue in Detroit, or at least there's been one in production for about 20 years or something, and it's
like
cost
like a big one,
massive. Yeah.
Oh my god, amazing!
And it's bronze, and it
Michelangelo's David.
It's cost like a shit ton of money. It's caused no end of controversy. I don't know if it ever got finished, but like, I'm like, that would be amazing though.
It would be fantastic.
Like, if you turn around the corner and there's like a 12-foot RoboCop statue.
I would go to Detroit to see the RoboCop statue.
Oh, by the way,
just alone.
And on the subject of, you know, 80s action, I watched Predator the other day.
Oh, I saw this the last time I was on Letterboxd. Yes.
An absolutely insane film. The inexplicably I'd never seen from start to finish, which makes no sense because, you know, you're like, how have you avoided this film for so long? I've seen loads of bits from it.
Yeah.
I knew the entire plot. I knew the fate of every character. But, you know, I never actually watched it start to finish. So.
I think the last time I would have seen it from start to finish was probably 2004.
That's very specific.
I would say that's how long ago.
But something really stood out to me when I watched the Predator film.
Tell me.
That the Predator is the most insecure villain in cinema history. He's pathetic.
Show your workings.
So he's 8 feet tall, right? Yeah. He's built like a fucking like bodybuilder.
Yeah.
He has future technology that no one else has, including the ability to be invisible. And he just, like, cheats. Like, it's meant to be about, like, he's an elite hunter and he's trying to test himself against the best or something. That's what these films turn into. It's not a very good franchise, but, like, the first film is particularly, it's great. But, like, it's just baffling. I was like, this is not a fair fight. Like, what's the point of this? It's like playing a fucking video game with all the cheats on.
Yeah. That's
what a badass. Like when Carl Weathers, RIP, dies in this film, RIP again, it's like...
Spoiler for a film that came out in
1987,
okay.
Do you know the director, tangent within a tangent here, John McTiernan directed this,
okay.
Die Hard, and The Hunt for Red October in the space of 4 years.
Fucking lean trio.
Pretty good. So, no, sorry, just real quick, on this digression that I'm sure everyone's enjoying at home, Carl Weathers plays, you know, they're all badass military men. It's comical. It's testosterone, the movie. Yeah. And, like, as we all know, like, there's a bit where they take their shirts off, but then put their tactical vest back on. And I'm like, why? Like, what was the point of this?
Too hot.
They're always rippling in the sun. Fair play to them. Mm-hmm. They look amazing. But here's the thing, right? Carl Weathers gets his arm blown off by the Predator, who shoots him from distance like a fucking coward, blows his arm off. And as Carl Weathers is hysterical and in agony and scared, probably, you get this bizarre, like, hero shot of the invisible Predator doing this kind of weird, like, circle run, like he's an Olympian, as he just runs up and guts him. And I was like, well, that was unnecessary showmanship. What are you doing? Like, I couldn't get... And then at the end, of course, you know, spoilers for Predator, Arnie defeats him, outwits him, outfoxes the alien, fair play.
With future technology.
No, he actually uses primitive technology.
No, as in the alien has future technology and was outwitted.
And then, what does the Predator do? Blows himself up in a nuclear explosion to try and take Arnie with him. Lose with some fucking dignity, please. Anyway, Rage Against the Machine. Let's talk about
Some might say that's what the Predator did. It raged against the machine.
It certainly did, yeah.
The machine that is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It was announced recently by Brad Wilk, the drummer from Rage Against the Machine, that they were done, that their reunion was over, and they were, you know, I mean, we've known for a while that they're not going to make any more new music for whatever reason, but if you ask Timmy C., Tim Comerford, the bass player from the band, he's saying something slightly different. So he's saying that actually he doesn't know, which is kind of bizarre, right? You would think it's definitely over. He said, when speaking to Rolling Stone, he said, I don't know. I don't get involved in that. I'm the bass player. I just wait for someone to tell me what to do. Brad said what he said, but he's one step above me. He's in the number three spot. I am the low man on the totem pole. That's all I can tell you. I'm the bass player. The bass players always are the last people to find out about shit like that.
I
would have thought, and
I'm
say
not
this,
buying what he's selling there, to be honest.
As a drummer, I would have thought the drummer was the lowest one on the totem pole.
I would have also thought the same thing. But again, every band is different. Like, this is perpetuating band stereotypes that, like, do not exist. I don't, like, obviously Zach De La Rocca and, oh my God, the guitarist, what's his name?
Tom Morello?
Tom Morello. Oh my God, how did I forget that? Sorry.
Thomas Morello.
Thomas Morello. I imagine they're probably on level peg and Zach De La Rocca, the mastermind behind Rage Against the Machine. I think we can all agree. It's kind of like if one person says it's over, I mean, it probably is, or at least their time in it is probably done. I don't know. There's a lot of mixed signals happening here, quite literally, as is the headline.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I thought they were done. I guess we'll see. But
I'm just the bass player.
He's got a new. He's got a new band. He's also recovering from prostate cancer. Apparently, he's doing well. But he said it has changed his life, and he has to continue to keep on that one. But we wish him well and hope that the band can back. And more importantly, as I always say, please make another album. It's not like you don't have the inspiration.
Before we move on, isn't there a Zach De La Rocca or like a Rage Against the Machine Trent Reznor produced record somewhere.
It's a Zach De La Rocca solo album.
Oh my God.
And
why?
Zach didn't think it was good enough.
Oh, for fuck's
sake. He put it in the vault, Prince style. And like, there is that track though, from the Fahrenheit 9/11 soundtrack. And the track is called We Want It All.
Mm.
And it's fucking amazing.
I don't recall it immediately.
Great. It's so, so good.
Is it worth not having the record to have that one?
So? No, this doesn't make any sense. Anyway, well, you could have something else, though. You could have a really bizarre piece of memorabilia. Now, I initially misread this slightly. A bullet once fired from the gun that killed John Lennon has gone up for auction this week.
Okay, so can we break this down?
Yeah, this is the thing, because I initially got a little bit confused.
Yeah, 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 because you text me this.
We did,
during
yeah.
the week. You were
I said to you, because I assumed, as you might be assuming, listener, I assumed that this was the bullet that killed him. And I was like, that's really fucked up. And
yeah.
I joked to you, I'm going to buy this and wear it around my neck on a first date.
Yeah.
And I was imagining, like, you know, you're like a couple of drinks in and she's looking at it and I'm like, oh, this? You know?
Yeah, your quote was, it belonged to a legend.
It belonged to a legend.
And I didn't know whether you meant the man who killed John Lennon or John Lennon himself.
That's the wonder of the ambiguity of the gag, which I will not be explaining. But I'm like, yeah, this belonged to a great man. Same again. But yeah, so no, it's not quite that. To explain, the item, this being the bullet, mm-hmm. not the bullet that killed John Lennon. The item was given to Northumbria police officer Brian Taylor. So this is in England, but it was given to him by the New York Police Department after they allowed this UK police officer to shoot the gun on a visit to the department in New York. This is so complicated.
By the way, the layers are so deep, listener. You may have to go on half speed for this.
The guy who got the bullet recently passed away, RIP, and now the bullet will be going under the hammer. It's actually like, once this podcast is out, it will be done. He kept the bullet in a frame for the rest of his life, with the auction house's director describing it as, quote, one of those slightly macabre lots you get now and again that draws everyone's attention.
Can I just interject for a moment?
Sure, yeah.
There's nothing macabre about the fact that it's a bullet that just happened to be fired from the same gun.
There is a Beatles fan base that is fanatical, this auction person says, and a market for just about anything Beatles. But very seldomly do you get something so unusual and unique. It's difficult to know what it's worth and whether there's a market for it or not. It's a really interesting piece of Beatles memorabilia.
No, it's fucking
probably
not.
Probably can't be replicated.
Yeah, because it doesn't exist in the first place.
Also, it can be replicated. Just put another bullet in the gun and fire it. Also,
there's probably several more.
Also, sorry, what's going on in that evidence room?
Sorry,
hey man,
can't.
Do you want to come in here for a second? Here's the gun that killed John Lennon. Do you want to fire it?
I'm reading the first line of that. Like,
how is that okay?
That BBC quote, that there is a Beatles fan base that is fanatical and a marker for just about anything. I can hear him from here rubbing his hands together at the thought of how much money this is going to generate. I genuinely hope it doesn't sell. It will. I hope it doesn't, just because it's so ridiculous.
But also, like, we know that the Beatles fan base is fanatical.
Yeah.
Why? Because a man shot and killed John Lennon. His name is Mark David Chapman. Killed him in 1980 outside his building in New York. He's in prison, as you might imagine. In 2022, he said that he shot John Lennon because he wanted to be somebody and nothing was going to stop that. Well, he was correct. He's been denied parole 12 times.
13 time lucky.
Including, I think, as recently as last Christmas, possibly.
Imagine still trying to get parole.
Well, he's
after saying, I did this because I wanted to.
He's saying that he's changed. You know, he feels more and more shame each year. You know, 30 years ago, I didn't feel shame. Now I know what shame is.
Good, serve your time.
I'm currently rewatching Oz.
The prison drama.
Because life isn't bleak enough, you know. I've decided, you know what, I'm going to watch Oz.
I think I watched like 5 episodes and just had to stop.
Oh, you haven't actually seen...
I haven't seen the full thing. I think I just like wasn't in the best place mentally to be consuming material of that nature.
It's intensely dark and I'm currently... It's worrying me how easy it's going down.
The theme song is so unnerving in itself.
It's incredible.
It's great. No, it's great.
We have played a bit of on the show before. So.
And several times.
It's an incredible show. It's on Paramount Plus, by the way, if anybody wants to watch a show from an era where, like, because, like, it never looked good. It's basically, if anyone doesn't know what Oz is, it's HBO's show, predates The Sopranos.
It was one of their first like big.
I think it was the first things, yeah. Kind of, you know, premium cable. So like there's lots of, you know, sex and violence, and it's so, and murder. It's so grim. But like the way that it's been uploaded is like fucking hell. It's like 4:3.
Oh, does it like do the screen? Does it like widening out of ratio or whatever?
Yeah, two black bars on the side. No attempt to upscale the presentation whatsoever.
Oh yeah, so it's, you're like watching in like 360p,
240p. Yeah, like it's just like which, you know, which kind of works in one sense, and another sense you're like, could you not have like done anything?
To this? Yeah, like something, please. Yeah,
it's an amazing show, not for the faint of heart. But last point on it. Harold Perrineau, who people will know from Lost, and also from, he's Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet. Yep. Really good actor.
Yeah, great actor.
He serves, he's a character within the Prison of Oz, but he's also the show's kind of narrator. And every episode is all about a theme. And about four or five times during the episode, you know, especially at the beginning, at the end, you'll have him in this kind of glass box prison cage thing. And he's like going through the themes and such. And he also introduces all the new prisoners when they go in there from while they're there. It is one of the most electrifying acting performances I've ever seen.
He's fantastic.
It is so consistently brilliant and so entertaining and incredible, and he does not get enough praise for it.
Yeah, it's magnetic. And like, I love the, when he does the introductions for the prisoners.
Prisoner number 67892, Adam Shanahan, convicted July 12th, 1998.
Third degree murder.
Sentence, 12 years. Up for parole in six.
Yeah, it's great. It's absolutely so good. Fantastic.
Go watch Oz, everybody, but seriously, don't binge it. I'm binging it. It's a mistake.
It's hard to swallow.
Listen, controversial show. Very controversial.
Yes, controversial.
However, our top five this week. Yeah, bizarre music controversies.
Yes.
And I feel bad because we had a guest lined up and we were going to do it with them. And I said to him, I was like, well, look, listen, I kind of need to do the top five. I was like, otherwise you don't have an episode. So yeah. he gave us our blessing.
So I will say the patrons of the show will know who the guest was this week.
Right, yeah.
So I'm going to...
What a teaser that is. Go find out who wasn't on the show.
No, I'm going to now tell everybody. So
Do we
need to do that?
No, it's fine.
Okay, secrets for the patrons only. Patreon.com/NoEncore, €5 to find out who
it was. Keep it as a mystery. They'll be back soon. We can get into it then.
Yeah.
But in the meantime... we need to talk about what we're doing, which is this controversial list. Yeah. I mean, there's lots to choose from, and we kind of deliberately steered away from really grim stuff because, first of all, fish in a barrel, and second of all, we're trying to find, you know, stuff that we're like, really, or like, you know, why was that a thing, and maybe how has time looked upon some of these as well? You know, I mean, like, has any, you know, do we feel differently about them now? Where are they overblown then? But yeah, nothing horrible, nothing fucking grim, no like awful stuff.
No.
That was kind of our remit, really.
No, and then there's like, it's stuff as well that, you know, was big news, which I think we were trying to keep stuff to like genuine, like big news in the music industry.
I'm laughing because like when our number one is like, by comparison, is a lot more local.
A lot more localized.
Yeah.
But like, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like that was kind of our search parameter, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the lighthearted stuff that... we just couldn't ignore.
It's true. And there's also, there are musicians on this show, and I believe you told me today that apparently this is episode 400.
This is episode 400, yeah.
Didn't realize it was that.
Yeah, so I just want to say, on mic, a massive congratulations to you, because you've been here for every episode.
That's true.
And
almost every episode.
That's like, that's a massive achievement. There's people who really, really love the show, so.
Yeah. And yeah, thanks to everyone. Like, if there's anyone even who's been listening all the way through, good Lord, I owe you lots of pints and stuff. But no, seriously, thanks to everybody. I'm not good at saying, hey, this is good and I'm great. I'm much better if someone goes, you know, the show sucks, Dave. I'm like, unreal, let's have a conversation about that. But yeah, it's been going for quite some time. And
2016, I believe.
2016, yeah. April 2016, I think, if I recall correctly. And yeah, it's a pleasure to do it, especially when we get to do stuff like this. But what the point I was going to make was, there are musicians that have appeared in one form or another over and over and over and over and over again. And I guess we'll continue to, because they're so sewn into the fabric of music itself. And even if I'm not the biggest fan of them, you just can't escape them. And, you know, you have to look at the influence. You have to look at, you know, the place in music history. And where better to start than our number five? Take it away, boys.
He said, oh, I don't know what's wrong with the church at the moment. The Beatles are bigger than Jesus Christ. You know, like, they're not building Jesus enough. They ought to do more, like gospel and all this stuff. Well, that was taken out of context over in America.
If it had said, "We're more television is more popular than Jesus," I might have got away with it. Happened to be talking to a friend. I used the word Beatles as a remote thing, not as what I think, as Beatles as though those other Beatles, like other people see us. I just said they are having more influence on kids and things than anything else, including Jesus. But I said it in that way, which is the wrong way. Yap, yap. I wasn't knocking it or putting it down. I was just saying it as a fact. And it sort of, it is true, especially more for England than here. You know, I'm not saying that we're better or greater or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever it is. You know, I just said what I said and it was wrong or was taken wrong and now it's all...
Yeah, so that's when the Beatles reportedly declared themselves to be bigger than Christ himself. I mean, in the context of the music industry, they're correct.
Yeah, 100%.
Shane Lynch might see it differently, but you heard Paul McCartney at the start there reflecting on this and looking back. I thought it was very interesting. And then you heard John Lennon kind of talking in an interview about the furore that happened. I'll give you the further context in just a second, but I thought it was quite interesting that Paul McCartney said that, you know, he was taken out of context, because that makes this one of the earliest kind of recorded massive mainstream entertainment cases of that happening.
I think it probably... I would say probably was.
Certainly to the extent. So basically for the context, and I will now quote from Rolling Stone's 50 Worst Decisions in Music piece, which, by the way, goldmine.
Yeah, fantastic read.
Goldmine for you, listener, and also goldmine for us, because we'll definitely be taking further inspiration from there down the line. In February 1966, John Lennon was speaking to Maureen Cleave, a reporter for the Evening Standard, when he began pontificating about religion. "Christianity will go," he said. "It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right, and I'll be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which would go first, rock and roll or Christianity." So that's what he was saying. Didn't provoke much of a stir in England, but in America.
Naturally, America.
In America. they weren't happy. Radio stations all across the state banned the Beatles' music.
The South.
Yeah,
of course.
Where else? There was an event in Georgia where their records were burned in a bonfire. And then when the Beatles came to America a few months later, there was protests at some of the shows, empty seats at other shows as well. It says here it was a miserable time for the entire band and they never toured again. Now, they obviously broke up for different reasons, but that, you know, it's a chronological factor. Mm-hmm. Christians weren't happy. The Bible Belt, as we say, weren't happy. Apparently, the Ku Klux Klan protested one of their concerts. So fine. Like, I mean, I think the Beatles win that
probably
one.
I was just going to say, probably going to side with the four lads there. Yeah.
Yeah, the lesser of two evils. But here's the thing, right? John Lennon didn't, you know, he heard him in that clip, you know, he's saying, like, I didn't fucking say that, I said this. And it's like, well, you know, he wasn't quite as declarative as the subsequent controversy. Mm-hmm. But he did say, we're more popular than Jesus now. He did say those words.
Yeah.
He's making a broader point. But also, like, was he wrong?
No, I don't think he was. I think it's it was Beatlemania, not Biblemania back then. You know, like,
it was Hulkamania.
It was Hulkamania. A couple of decades later, yeah.
Still is.
Yeah. I don't know. I really enjoyed listening to John Lennon being like, I didn't say that we're bigger than Jesus. Almost to be like, but we are, and you know that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, like, I think
it's a totally fair point. And also,
it's
like,
massively fair.
I'm not a Beatles fan, and I'm much less a John Lennon fan, but I will say, like, you know, I have no problem with a rock star being a rock star.
Yeah, and, like, they were massive. They were, like, the biggest thing in the world. The biggest thing in the world. Everybody knew about the Beatles. Everybody. Like, not saying that no one, you know, there were people that didn't know about Jesus, but, no, I mean, there probably were. Even still...
Jesus Christ's PR game was stronger, Adam. I'm just going to say at that point.
Well, yeah, he's been around for a while.
Continues to be.
I don't know. I think that...
It's funny because...
I think this is so fine. Like, this wouldn't even make news today.
Well, that's the thing. It's very of its time. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, again, generation through generation and, you know, fucking form of expression through form of expression. Everything's been done now. This was different. We weren't living in that time. And you could probably feel it in the air. This is kind of thing that you don't say in certain parts of the world, particularly the States at that time and certain sections of the States.
I think probably still a little bit in certain parts of the States.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. But I do think it's interesting, though, that because I've always said that, you know, the Beatles, the endurance, the fucking chokehold that the Beatles still have over popular culture.
Yeah.
For
Sam Mendes in particular.
Jesus Christ. Four fucking films. It's been a running joke amongst me and my friends for a long time that Dave Hanratty hates the Beatles. I don't hate them. I just don't like them. I never got it. Maybe I'm probably the problem. It's fine. But like, I think it's funny that it's taboo to this day to say, I don't like the Beatles. People lose their fucking minds. But this was so taboo and they were involved and they said it. I do have to wonder, like, you know, how throwaway of a comment was it for him?
I feel like it had to have been a big throwaway thing where he was just like, you know, at the end of the sentence, as opposed to him literally like looking at a journalist right in the eyes and saying, look at me. We are bigger than Jesus.
You can quote me on that.
Print that, yeah. You know.
Print the legend. Yeah. But no, it's funny. Again, you know, I'm calling it a bizarre controversy.
I think, yeah.
I'm saying it's overblown. But of course, as we say, time is a factor. And back in mid-1960s, you know, it's going to be a lot different. But
it would have been considered a faux pas by many.
Somebody would have fainted, you know?
Yeah, But and, like, and for the wrong reasons. The Beatles wanted people to faint for the right reasons.
Yeah, during, like, you know, Twist and Shout or something. But I mean, like, it's the thing where it's like, they had a right to say it, you know? They had a right. And I guess people had a right to react, but it is just, it's a comical thing. They, as you say, probably wouldn't see today. But what you would see today, though, Adam, are YouTube comments. Earnest YouTube comments.
Yes.
And I did, you know, the video that I saw there.
Oh, thank God for this.
The video I saw there of the John Lennon quote and the whole thing. There was only a couple of comments, and only one stood out to me. And it was written 7 months ago.
Oh, yes, recent.
And it says, and I quote...
5,000 likes?
I'm 63 years old.
Oh, yeah, this is perfect. Okay, it's following the formula note for note right now. We're one for one.
Literally almost quoting Royal Yellow 2 weeks ago on the Simpsons episode when he like had one that ended with, like, I'm 75 years old. Okay, actual quote below this John Lennon quote thing. I'm 63 years old. I was brought up Roman Catholic, now agnostic. Watching this video brings back some unpleasant memories. Kind of hard to listen to this today, even though I doubt the existence of God. I guess that Catholicism stays within your heart, regardless of your current beliefs.
Look,
how does YouTube keep doing it?
The YouTube's clientele.
The most earnest comment
corner.
YouTube
comments clientele, I should say. Everyone watches YouTube. But, like, YouTube comments clientele, the people who take the time to write stuff like that.
So personal.
Make me so happy.
So personal.
Like, even the sad stories, I'm just like, I'm so glad that you shared that. Because, like, it's so earnest. Everything is so earnest.
It's astonishing. It's wonderful. Like, I had to just stop my tracks.
He means every word of that.
100%. By the way. 100%. Now, okay.
Or she.
I think it's a man.
Okay.
Rich is the first. But it could be anything. I don't know. Who cares? Who fucking cares? be whoever you
be
are.
You like.
Be happy in yourself.
You're accepted here at No Encore.
Absolutely. But will number four be accepted by the listeners of No Encore? Because this is one. I think this is a really interesting one. I think time has been very interesting on this one. So, I've got a bunch of clips from this one, but we're going to start with one to just give you a little bit of an explainer. It should be all you need. Here is our number four in bizarre music controversies.
Now, this is not just about music, Charlie. We are probably right now 2 to 3 months away from having a situation where you can download a 90-minute motion picture in real time. So the day Gladiator opens in a theater near you, you can sit there and swap, or whatever nice word they use, swap Gladiators or whatever other motion pictures
around.
How
about around. Share files?
Sharing? I don't, this is not sharing. If me and you share a sandwich, I'm left with half a sandwich.
Oh, but you know what they would say? But you.
This is duplicating.
They would
this is
say,
not
no, no,
sharing.
But what they would say.
Last spring, Ulrich showed up at Napster's office with the names of 300,000 users that he said had illegally downloaded Metallica songs.
Who is that handsome man with the beautiful voice?
I think we all know who it is. Regular listeners of the show will know that that's Lars Ulrich.
It's Lars Ulrich, Sticksman for Metallica, and sandwich enthusiast.
Yeah,
and
yeah, definitely. He was very cross about the whole sandwich situation.
That's him talking on 60 Minutes. They did a special episode about Metallica taking on Napster. Napster, of course, if anyone does not remember, was a file sharing service, a platform that emerged in the early 2000s, and it was all about getting music for free.
Nemesis of the music industry at the time.
Questionable legality.
Yeah, because it was the first kind of
It was illegal.
It was illegal, yeah. But it was like the first peer-to-peer file sharing platform so to speak.
Yeah, and a big gat like LimeWire and, you know, some other ones. But it was big news at the time, and some musicians did not take this lying down, and that was certainly the case for Lars Ulrich. So, before you proceed with this, the 60 Minutes episode, as you might imagine, it's very of its time. So can I just give you the intro? The intro from the episode, it starts off and you got like Sean Fanning of Napster, but it's just all very like, you know, set in the scene, and it's so wonderfully of its time. So let's take a listen to how that episode began.
I would say it definitely bothers me. I mean, to me, it's upsetting to know that we've built something that 30 million people love and has so much potential, and the fact that it could be destroyed or could be lost is definitely upsetting.
Napster is enabling millions of people to get free music with just a few keystrokes at their computers. The idea is deceptively simple. It's called file sharing. Computer users store their music collections, everything from the Beatles to Britney Spears, in their computers. When they link up with Napster, it then acts as a central hub that brings everyone together, allowing people to swap music computer to computer without paying a dime.
There you go. Isn't it gorgeous? Like the key tapping.
It's fantastic. I can see everything in that. Can see that, like, it's so, the keyboard is so yellow. It's unbelievable.
The weird sinister music there when it was like, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. When it's like, they can exchange files for free.
And not pay a dime. Yeah. So I'm going to quote now from an article in Kerrang! Magazine in April 2021, written by Sam Law. It's called Metallica versus Napster, the lawsuit that redefined how we listen to music. Kind of just picking up on the application and advancement of Napster. So when the program went live later that summer, it did so with unprecedented popularity right out of the gate. Millions of tracks were accessible almost overnight. User numbers were doubling every few weeks. In an era when the vast majority of music was still physically purchased on compact disc, an untold variety was made accessible to any listener with access to a PC and a decent internet connection. The increasing prevalence of CD burning equipment further facilitated an illicit trade. Naturally, all of this was illegal. Prior to that point, music had been a collectible. Suddenly, it was disposable. It goes on to mention that the original anti-Napster lawsuit was filed at the beginning of the year 2000 by the Recording Industry of America for copyright infringement. But of course, as we know, and as we are here to discuss further, it caught the attention of a particular band when a Metallica song by the name of I Disappear, which was written for what film? Summer blockbuster.
Oh, God. I feel like I know this.
A summer blockbuster that also boasted a new metal version of the famous theme tune.
Oh, it was Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah.
The Metallica song is I Disappear. It's a fucking banger. And it got back to Metallica, basically, that the song had leaked and had been appearing on the internet, and that's how they learned about Napster. So I want to play you a clip now. This is a couple minutes long. It's taken from Lars Ulrich's opening speech. Now, if you can imagine him much like Ryan Tuberty was at the Oireachtas Committee last summer.
He just wanted the Napster users to learn how to read?
Pretty much, yeah. He just wants the Napster users to listen to music again. Basically, he's in front of a Senate judiciary hearing, and it's a long clip in general, but I've cut it down to about 2 pertinent minutes. And let's just hear what Lars had to say at the time when he was speaking, you know, in a government broadcast. So here we go.
With Napster, every song by every artist is available for download at no cost. And of course, with no payment to the artist, the songwriter, or the copyright holder. If you're not fortunate enough to own a computer, there's only one way to assemble a music collection, the equivalent of a Napster user: theft. Walk into a record store, grab what you want, and walk out. The difference is that the familiar phrase, files done, is now replaced by another familiar phrase, you're under arrest. Since what I do is make music, let's talk about the recording artist for a moment. When Metallica makes an album, we spend many months and many hundreds of thousands of our own dollars writing and recording. We typically employ a record producer, recording engineers, programmers, assistants, and occasionally other musicians. We rent time for months at recording studios, which are owned by small businessmen who have risked their own capital to buy, maintain, and constantly upgrade very expensive equipment and facilities. Our record releases are supported by hundreds of record companies, employees, and provide programming for numerous radio and television stations. Add it all up and you have an industry with many jobs, a few glamorous ones like ours, and lots more covering all levels of the pay scale and providing wages which support families and could contribute to our economy. Remember, too, that my band Metallica is fortunate enough to make a great living from what we do. Most artists are barely earning a decent wage and need every source of revenue available to scrape by. Also keep in mind that the primary source of income for most songwriters is from the sale of records. Every time a Napster enthusiast downloads a song, it takes money from the pockets of all these members of the creative community. It is clear then that if music is free for downloading, the music industry is not viable. All the jobs I just talked about will be lost and the diverse voices of the artists will disappear. The argument I hear a lot, that music should be free, must then mean that musicians should work for free. Nobody else works for free. Why should musicians?
Now, a couple of takeaways before we get into the meat of this. Yeah. One, boy, was he popping on that microphone.
Oh my God, yeah, the plosives were unbelievable. That man needed three pop shields.
Two, I don't think he had a single one. Two,
sounds like he didn't.
Do you want to reiterate? Because I think it's kind of a given, it's kind of a taken for granted thing. But like Lars Ulrich is not a popular figure even before this. He is something of a joke to a lot of people, even people who love metal. They're like, can't stand that guy. Don't think he's a great drummer.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Some Kind of Monster, once again, I'm imploring you to do so. This does get covered in it. So you know you're dealing with a divisive figure anyway. You know, three. I don't want to find myself here going to bat for the record labels. That's not what I want, the argument I want to make. What I do want to say, and I should say as well, of course, Metallica were crucified for this. For like, once Lars Ulrich made this speech, once they did what they did, especially outing the names of people who illegally downloaded their music, Metallica were absolutely fucking destroyed. Metallica fans, in some cases, turned their backs on them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I want to ask, though, 2024.
Yeah.
20 years later.
Yeah.
Was Lars Ulrich right?
Yes.
Because whether it was YouTube comments today, Reddit threads, drop down comments on other, you know, kind of articles about this, et cetera, et cetera, I'm seeing an awful lot of people say he was right. And he nailed what would happen and what did happen. And you hear him there. And again, like I say, you know, just to cover all bases here, just to cover all angles, he is talking about, you know, independent musicians, people who, you know, hire studios and run them, et cetera, et cetera. And he is also making the point in the same breath that, you know, yes, I know I'm a massive multimillionaire, but it's not like he's done much to facilitate that in the other direction. I mean, like, you know, was he just paying lip service? Did he care? But at the same time, is the argument correct? Because again, like, I can't stress this enough. Lars Ulrich was fucking destroyed for these comments. But one more time, I'll say it. Was he right?
Yes. And I have a very, I suppose, some might say biased view, but I have a viewpoint of this from as an arts worker. I am one of those people that he spoke about in the statement. You know, I have a studio here. My job is a producer primarily, and like, you know, I work on podcasts too. But like, again, I think that he was 100% correct. And it's the thing that resonated most was people, the sentiment that music should be free, it 100% insinuates without any doubt that musicians should work for free. And the music, like, I think that as well, just moving slightly laterally from that as well, like, he was right to stand up for himself and for the music industry when this happened, because this was the start of the complete devaluation of the music industry. Like, right now, he's talking about going to a studio and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to make a record, employing all these people. That doesn't happen anymore. Like, unless you're Taylor Swift, even if you're Taylor Swift, probably not the case. You know, if you're Dua Lipa, maybe. But like, who else is doing things like that? Like, I can't, like, even if you're looking at behind the scenes of big artists out there nowadays, Dermot Kennedy, Hozier, Taylor Swift, like, you're not seeing what we saw in Some Kind of Monster. You're not seeing that kind of level of, you know, people going away for months and just dedicating time to making this record.
Some people would say in the same breath, though, that if the end product is Saint Anger,
okay, well, look,
maybe we shouldn't
I'm going to sidestep that one real quick.
Sure, of course. I say Taylor Swift probably is spending that amount of money, but again, as you say, you're talking about, like, you know, at 1%. You know?
If I'm thinking, like, what he's saying as well, are, like, you know, arts workers are people who don't make a lot of money. Musicians generally are people who don't make a lot of money. He's right. Like, at the ground level, at grassroots level, it's fucking hard. I know so many people who are balancing 2-3 jobs.
Well, he wasn't. Again, we do need to unlearn.
No, but again,
this is a multimillionaire who has only got more money since Metallica are a brand. They are a fucking, like, you know, they are like Kiss. They have a TM next to their name. That's fine. But, like, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to just fully say, yeah, man, Lars is right on. But he was protecting his corner. Although
he's 100%,
he'd every right to protect his corner. Yeah. And he makes the point, you know, in the full 8-minute speech that he does say, he's like, you know, he's like, we didn't make this decision. He's like, I have no problem with people giving away music for free, but we didn't get to make that decision.
Yeah. And but what I will say, and to go back to it, is, like, despite whether or not it was cynical, him batting for the small town musician here, there and everywhere, he's right. Like, whether you want him to be or not, and whether he is a cynic or not a cynic, or you like him or you don't like him, I can take or leave him. I think what he said is, like, A1, and it's, that statement has aged so well in the age of streaming as well. If it wasn't for these peer-to-peer file sharing networks like LimeWire, like Napster, that completely devalued music, brought it down to a file and just split it all over the thing. I thought the sandwich analogy was absolutely hilarious. I don't think that's very accurate, but, like,
it's a funny analogy.
Yeah. But the whole thing is, like, the streaming services then came in later with this thing, this, you know, subscription-based model for access to music. But they're, like, realistically, if Napster wasn't there, if Napster never happened, if this peer-to-peer file sharing stuff never happened, shoulda, woulda, coulda, of course, but streaming services might have come along and there might have been more value given back to the artists. We mightn't be having the conversation we're having now about royalties being paid to the artists. I imagine they would be smaller.
Well, what I wanted to ask, though, was, again, because you have to look at the other side of it. And, for example, there are people who to this day will say that Sean Fanning and Sean Parker were rock stars. And what they did, they were the Robin Hood. You know, they brought down the big label, the evil corporate greed, boom, 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 boom. And it was time for a change. And it was time to try and give something back to someone else. And, you know, we shouldn't have to pay this and blah, 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 blah. You know, like, there are people who will romanticize that and will say that actually what they did was right and not wrong. But then again, what is the end result? I'm not, like, you know, whether it's directly from Napster or not, we are looking at Spotify now. No one makes any fucking money and it's making it, it's going even worse. I don't know. It's not that I'm, like, you know, 100% team Lars, yes, although I do think he's an overhated person personally. But overall, it was like something had to burst in that industry.
Yeah,
but I don't know if this was the way. And, like, in fairness, like I used Napster, of course, LimeWire, of course, I did it
as well. But
and now, like, I pay for Spotify, you know, yeah. which arguably is worse.
Yeah, and but then, like, again, there are models that do prioritize the artist. Like, Tidal do pay quite a premium on royalties to their artists based on their stream counts and all the rest of it. But, like, I do find the argument that, what's it, Sean Parker, right? That was, mm-hmm. Yeah. I do find...
Well, Sean Fanning. Parker's also involved at a certain point, I believe.
Yeah. So Sean Fanning, like, I find the argument that, like, you know, well, we shouldn't have to pay for this. That, like, would you go into a shop, take a Mars bar and say the same thing and walk out and expect not to have a security person chase you down for shoplifting? Because that's essentially what it was doing. And again, there is a level of hypocrisy there, because I did partake in this, but I am now, like, my eyes have widened to the detriment it is to the arts worker to want, and it's devaluing art and it's devaluing music. And, like, these are things that are so intrinsic to all of our lives. I don't know anyone who isn't, you know, into some form of the arts, whether, like, you might not be a big music person, but you're a big film or TV person. Like, this is all the same thing. It's why the SAG union members struck out for the longest time. It's why people are now putting it up to Spotify on the basis that Spotify have turned around and said they're reducing their fucking royalty rates for streams coming out, and they're not going to pay out past a certain threshold, which is fucking daylight robbery. If they're making a loss, they need to figure that out and not pass it on to the artists. It's devaluing art. I think Lars is 100% right.
Yeah, and there's a lot of passive acceptance in it. We're all kind of culpable to some degree. I will say Lars Ulrich, to me, is probably the living embodiment of the two things can be right at the same time.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
We'll give him the last word. I want to just give him one more clip. This is him speaking in, I think, 2013 to the Huffington Post. So, you know, some time has elapsed and he's looking back on what went down and how he feels about it then.
Alex Winter just came out with a documentary called Downloaded, which rehashes the Napster saga. Yeah. We have a comment from one of our producers, Ricky Camilleri, saying, does Lars regret the way in which he handled Napster back in the day? It said the music industry has lost billions not harnessing the power of tech between, during, and after Napster.
No, I'm not a guy who sort of carries regret around with me on my shoulders a lot. I'd say the only regret about that 13 years ago was that we were not quite prepared. I think you used the word shit before, so I'll say we weren't quite prepared for the shitstorm that sort of that we became engulfed in. You know, it started out as a street fight. It was basically, you know, there was a song that we were working on for the Mission Impossible 2 movie called I Disappear that all of a sudden showed up on radio stations across the country, but it wasn't even mixed, it wasn't even finalized.
I think so, I actually downloaded that one when I was in college.
Well, there you go.
I was very excited about it.
There you go.
And you know what? I bought the album when it came out.
There you go. But so it sort of showed up on all these radio stations across the country, and we were like, well, how did that happen? And I got a call from our office like the next day. It traces back to something called Napster, and we were like, well, if they're fuck with us, we'll fuck with them. And then it sort of turned into it started off a street fight, and then like a month later it was like, whoa, okay, look at this. And then we were sort of like a little bit like deer caught in headlights, and then obviously we stood our ground and fought the fight. But obviously it was a difficult time. I mean, it's not easy being finger whacked at that level, and especially, you know, because, you know, the Napster people were really smart in that they made the whole fight about, you know, about money and about, you know, Metallica sort of like technologically inept and they don't want to, you know, give stuff away for free. And we're like, well, hang on, it's not about money, it's about control.
Last thing on this, do you think that guy who said I bought the album when it came out bought the album when it came out?
No. No, he didn't. That is placating for placating sake.
I think he panicked when he said that he downloaded it and felt he had to rush to cover himself. Yeah. But also, it meant that he would have bought the Mission Impossible 2 soundtrack, which, you know.
I mean, no, legend.
Yeah. Could be. Now, I cede the floor to you for a number three.
Sure. Okay, so how to tee this up? I guess this is, you know, we're talking, you know, back a little bit from the Napster controversy, not really in the same world, but definitely a modern example of one of the most, I'd say, notorious groups of all time.
MC Ren, will you please give your testimony to the jury about this fucked up incident? Fuck the police!
Nice police are nice to me!
Was that no, it wasn't Alan Partridge.
No, it was Adam Buxton.
Adam Buxton,
Of Adam and Joe, and he does the fuck the police thing, but he's done the cleanup version.
Yeah, he turns it down.
It's a great bit. Go look it up, you know. He's like, you know what day it is today, Jasper? Thursday? Wrong. It's NWA Day. Yeah, it's great. It's a good bit. So NWA, yeah, you want to talk about them?
NWA, that song was Fuck the Police. It was a song released in 1988, which absolutely blew my mind that it wasn't in the 90s. I was convinced it was in the 90s. So yeah, just a bit of general background first before we get into the whole controversy and why this song in particular, you know, pulled on a lot of people's strings the wrong way.
Like it still would today.
Yeah, NWA, rap group formed in Compton, Los Angeles in the late 1980s, made up of Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, DJ Ella, Arabian Prince, and MC Ren. I think it's, you know, pretty safe to say that they were the forefathers of modern gangster rap music. Like, there was some happening in the New York kind of world. We had like Slick Rick doing a few bits and Grandmaster Flash, but it was very like soft. And it wasn't really, like, it was all sample-based, but it was generally breaks taken from Soul Records and stuff. And that is very much the same here. But the sound of the production here was what really changed the game in terms of gangster rap. It set the bar for those to come after, like Snoop Dogg, and, you know, that brought Death Row Records. Tupac got involved. Biggie then was kind of the same thing. And like all of that street culture became massive, massive, massive part of the lyrical content and rap in the 1980s. Or, sorry, 1990, should I say. So their debut album, Straight Outta Compton, was released in 1988 and was one of the first ever albums to contain the now widely recognised parental advisory label due to the explicit lyrics and theme throughout, which, you know, you heard a little bit of it there. These aforementioned lyrics and themes rendered the group banned from radio worldwide due to its quote-unquote extreme content. However, the media coverage made up for the lack of airplay and the album eventually went double platinum.
It's strange how that can happen, you know, when you introduce something like this.
I know, you wouldn't think it, would
the
you?
The parental advisory logo, I will say, is iconic. You know, it actually is, for all the reasons that they didn't intend. But I've got that image seared into my brain.
It was being, during my research for this, I saw that it was being tested out by the record companies at the time, but this one was the first, like, big release that they were like, fucking slap that on. And, you know, now... Again, we still see it. And like, you would associate a lot of rap records with that logo. Almost you wouldn't be able to see a lot of artwork without it.
Yeah. Metal as well, of course.
Metal too,
and I do know that our guest was going to pick Tipper Gore versus Twisted Sister and all the Satanic Panic stuff as well in the 80s.
Yeah.
A similar kind of deal where it's like, you know, lyrics that are demonizing our children, etc. But I guess this is more of an adult theme because, again, you know, you're taking aim directly at the establishment and the authorities.
Yeah.
And we can't have that.
Yeah. Quite
least of all from non-white people.
Quite literally. Like, so this song, Fuck the Police, had a massive backlash from politicians, activist groups, which is focus on the family, of course, and not least various law enforcement agencies, and so much so the FBI got directly involved, and this is the big controversy. So you know the background here
of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah,
I believe it was founded by J. Edgar Hoover.
No, as in the background based on like how the FBI got involved with NWA.
Well, I've seen the questionable film which depicts some of this.
Oh yeah, the dramatized version of it.
No, give it to me straight.
Yeah,
like
so,
a pear cider that's made from 110% pear.
So a letter was sent to the record label Priority Records by FBI Assistant Director Milt Aldrich, saying that advocating violence and assault is wrong and that we in the law enforcement community take exception to such actions. The full letter is currently available to view in...
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Correct.
Real? Yeah. Wow. Hey.
Then after that, policemen refused to provide security for the group's concerts, hurting their plans to tour. Nonetheless, the FBI's letter only served to draw more publicity to the group, thus assisting with the double platinum certification.
Yeah.
So,
nice job, guys.
Another fun fact, the only radio station that has been recorded, like there's a record of playing the song on radio, was Triple J in Australia, and it was banned after 6 months by the Broadcasting Commission, the Australian Broadcasting Commission.
Wow, I didn't even realise Triple J has been around that long.
Yeah. So that's Wikipedia being an absolute classic there.
Sure, second source, that shit.
I do have a clip of Ice Cube talking about the FBI letter and their kind of immediate reactions to it. Unfortunately, it's on Joe Rogan, but we don't hear too much of that, so.
Mercifully, thank you.
The day we got the FBI letter.
What was the FBI letter?
We got an FBI letter. They sent the letter to Priority Records saying, one guy was like, I'm, you know, part of this department of the FBI, and we're very concerned with this record called Straight Outta Compton. You guys got a song on there called Fuck the Police, and we think this song could encourage, people to go against law enforcement, and blah, blah, this, and blah, blah, that. And, basically, you know, we'd like it if you guys took it off the shelf, you know what I'm saying, to that tip. So, you know, they call us up there, you know, they panicking. We don't know why they want us to come. They just like, man, you got to come up here. We got to talk to you. We get up there and it's like, pull out this letter, FBI. And we're like... He's like, man, do you know what this is? This fucking agent, he sent me this letter, and, you know, they was all, like, nervous and shit. And we're looking like, a letter? That's all you get? They're not going to come in here and try to fuck with us? Like, they're not going to, you know what I mean, arrest us, cuff us, rough us up, none of that? And we're like, y'all scared over a fucking letter? Come back to South Central with us. You know what I mean? Deal with the sheriffs down there. You know what I mean? They do way more than give you a letter. So we felt that it was like, you know, Easy was like, we're going to be big as fuck after this. You know what I'm saying?
And Easy was right.
Yeah, I mean, like, as well, it's that thing of, while I'm sure the FBI were hardly going to, you know, stop to do this because why would they invite the bad publicity? This song exists for a reason. You know, it isn't just for the crack.
Not born out of nothing.
No, it's reflective of their lived experience and how black people were treated and continue to be. Yeah. Hello. Like, I mean, it's not like you're like, oh, like with stuff like the Bigger Than Jesus, you know, Beatles thing, you're like, well, that's such a product of its time and that exists in that very, you know, vacuumed time capsule space. With a song like Fuck the Police by NWA, it's depressingly more relevant than ever.
Yeah.
It's never not been relevant. It's never not been important. It's never not been brilliant, by the way. Like, even just as a surface level, as you say, the production, the sonics on that fucking record, not sound like an asshole, the sonics on that record, but like, it sounds
amazing.
It still sounds amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It still sounds amazing.
It's so, like, it's so iconic. It's so, so, so iconic as far as, like, rap beats go, as far as, like, the lyrics go. Like, even that just, like, scratched up bit where Eazy-E saying fuck the police. Like, it's like addictive, you know. And again, there's like a bit of levity injected in there with like everyone acting out the court scene, in, you know, in response to how cruel police officers were to young black people in Compton and in downtown Los Angeles in the late 80s. And even then, you know, we saw some horrible things come out of there in the 90s as well. So
yeah, I mean, like I say, it's never not been relevant, but I mean, like, again, it's just, it's the level of it. It's very funny that it completely backfired and that it created, I mean, like, you know, this is what you want. Again, whether it's NWA, whether it's Slipknot, you know, where, yeah. And again, like, I mean, that was another thing where it's, I think we would have discussed, like, I still can't confirm this. I don't know if it's real, but there was that story for years that, you know, Slipknot were banned from playing in Ireland by the Parents Council, the National Parents Council, which I guess is the thing. And it's like, you go online, you Google that, you'll find some forum threads talking about this, but I can find nothing to back this up.
Yeah.
I think it's completely apocryphal, but I do remember when I saw Slipknot in Belfast in 2002, and I remember Corey Taylor being like, you know, doing the requisite, you know, holding up a can of Guinness, but it's not even a can of Guinness, and he was like, I'm waiting a long time to do this kind of thing. So I don't know, maybe there is. If anyone knows, you know, by all means do let us know if Slipknot were in fact banned for a while. But yeah, it's just, if you tell people don't listen to this is bad for you,
yeah,
it's bad for your kids, the fuck thing's gonna happen, you know.
It's like, it's such a symbol of a generational divide as well, like,
because, completely,
because
yeah,
like it, you get there are clips of like the people in like forums, and I don't know if there was a court case or something against them at some point, or like some injunction that was put in to try and get this taken off the shelves. But what I do remember seeing people talk about this in like political forums and being like, this is terrible. This, and like, again, it's a real, won't someone please think of the children?
It's the video, like, nasties, it's ban this, yeah, sick filth, you know, it's the usual stuff.
Completely. And again, it's all like coming from a place of, there's a lot of like, again, that like, you know, Family First or whatever the name of the, you know, activist group was, is like massively religious, like massively religious. So of course this doesn't line up with their values. And again, of course the FBI are going to take, or law enforcement agencies are going to take, you know, umbrage with this kind of stuff. And again, like, it, but like, you know, you reap what you sow, I guess.
100%. Someone else who pushed the envelope quite a lot in their career is an artist who sadly is no longer with us, but here he is in our number two slot discussing a decision that was made that really, like, fucking blew people's minds back in the day.
You're an unusual person. Mm-hmm. Most people don't get famous with one name and then change it, mm-hmm, right, would you say? What's the story of that, by the way?
I had searched deep within my heart and spirit, and I wanted to make a change and move to a new plateau in my life. And one of the ways in which I did that was to change my name. It sort of divorced me from the past and all the hang-ups that go along with it.
Why then did you choose the artist formerly known as?
Well, I didn't choose that. That was chosen.
It chosen for you.
Yeah, pretty
what
much.
Would you have chosen?
I mean,
did you think of a name? What is your name at birth?
My name at birth was Prince Rogers Nelson. Yeah.
So did you think of Nelson?
No.
Rogers?
No.
Were you thinking of a name?
No, it didn't come to me like that.
So how did the artist formerly known as come about?
Well, that came up through people's problem with, mainly the media's problem with not having a pronunciation for the symbol. So they had to come up with something, I guess.
So the artist formerly known as is a media invention.
Yes, sir.
Not your invention.
The word icon is overused, of course, but how else do you describe the singularity, the unique force of nature, the unbelievable, just kind of otherworldly, you know, like just 75 different dimensional presence that was Larry King. And he was discussing, he was talking to Prince there, Prince Rogers Nelson, of course, the late Prince, who, of course...
Did you think of Nelson, Dave?
No.
Did you think of Rogers?
I did not, no. But Prince
enjoyed that a lot.
Prince did change his name to a symbol
in
the 90s. And let me tell you, it was the talk of the town. Because I grew up in a house where my siblings were big into Prince.
And how did they take this?
I think they were just kind of in lockstep with whatever he did. You know, it was like, all right, cool. This is different. You know, there certainly was no commotion that I can recall, but there was a lot of commotion in the media. A lot of people were just like, what the fuck is this? You know,
how dare he?
As if, by the way, Prince hadn't previously like been Prince and had been princing all over the place.
Do you not understand who this man is?
Yeah, just doing, you know, kind of unexpected, strange, controversial stuff anyway. I thought it was kind of cool. I mean, you know, but people really were kind of like, you know, turn their nose up at it, being like, how dare he? This is ridiculous. Who do you think we are? You know, we're going to, you know, accede to this, you know?
He was a real artist, wasn't he? Like he was
the artist formerly known as.
Yeah.
Well, as you heard him there, you know, it wasn't quite, you know, like he's making the claim there that actually, you know, it was one thing, but the media turned it into another thing, which of course goes back to the John Lennon thing, which goes back to everything and the taking out of context, which continues to happen all the time. To quote once again from Rolling Stone's 50 Worst Decisions in Music, they said that they believe that it was one of the worst decisions in music.
Where does it rank?
I didn't write down the number, and now I look like a terrible podcast host.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the higher ones.
Yeah.
They say Prince had every right to be frustrated with his Warner Brothers record label in 1993. He was recording music at a furious clip, and the company simply wasn't releasing it. He also felt the contract that he signed with the label all the way back in 1977 was unfair and essentially made him, quote-unquote, a slave. He decided the best way to fire back was to change his name to an unpronounceable symbol, thinking this would somehow nullify his contract. I'm sorry, I think that's brilliant.
It's definitely not going to do that.
That's not what happened. Warner Brothers wound up sending thousands of computer discs containing the symbol to media outlets so they could print his new name. They also referred to him as the artist formerly known as Prince. The whole gamut confused his fans and little to help with flagging record sales. He changed his name back in 2000. Now, there's a really good piece, actually, a very long piece in Variety from last summer, written by someone called Jem Aswad, who says that Prince's motivation for doing so was never clearly stated, although, you know, he certainly gives you some semblance over there in the Larry King clip. Many assume it's a ploy to get out of the contract, and so on and so forth. But, you know, the floppy disk thing, I think, is great because, you know, with the digital rendition of the image, because, you know, if I didn't explain that clear enough, it's like the symbol did not exist on the computer keyboard. So you're like, how are we going to do this? But, you know, the label circumvented that. And television outlets were also provided with a brief video featuring the symbol as well. So, like, it was just weird kind of corporate subterfuge by Warner Brothers with one of their leading artists, who I guess was, you know, causing them some trouble.
It really goes to show the lengths that a record label will go to, though, to avoid getting out of a contract.
And getting one over on them, yeah. So to quote from this Jem Aswad piece in Variety, which is worth checking out, it's very long. The symbol, originally a combination of the common gender symbols for male and female, previously had appeared in slightly different form in the artwork of several of his albums. First on 1999, later on The Sleeves of Purple Rain, Graffiti Bridge, on Tour Laminates and the like. However, because the symbol could not be copyrighted, Prince hired a Minneapolis design studio to alter it, adding a horn-like element. He copyrighted that version and first used it as the unpronounceable title of his otherwise titleless 1992 album, which is commonly referred to as Love Symbol. So there you go. I mean, it was bizarre.
I think bizarre, box ticked, controversy, box ticked. Like, again, it's like, it just goes, like, it's, it was, I think it was really smart. It was really inventive.
I think it was worth the gamble.
100%. Imagine that paid off. Imagine Metallica changing their name to I don't know, like the what's the death magnetic? What's the like? They have like a coffin with like the magnet thing.
Oh yeah, it looks terrible.
We could be calling them the artists formerly known as Metallica.
But like but if you're so established, you know, like if you're so like, again, Prince is a mononym, you know, and it's like so iconic. Again, I know I hate that word, but like you know, so known. Hey, everyone, it's Prince. You know, it's Madonna, it's Prince. You know, it's like.
But also, like, he never gave a fuck. Like, he never gave a fuck. He was always, like, just.
You know the infamous quote, don't you, when, like, it was, like, the whole, you know, him versus MCD thing over here?
No, I don't, no.
I think, like, it was one of the
gigs. What happened with that?
I think it was the Croke Park thing. I think tickets weren't selling or something, but there was some dispute. There was a dispute anyway, and, like, you know, apparently, like, you know, the word that came back from Prince to the head of MCD was, and I quote, "Tell that cat to chill."
Oh yeah, no, I do remember that.
Which
actually
is fucking great. Yeah. No. He was an absolute. He was a prick. You know, but he was an amazing prick.
Yeah, he had the art to back it up.
That's the thing.
I guess. Yeah.
Although he made so many terrible throwaway albums, especially towards the end.
Yeah.
Although, have you heard the song Black Sweat?
Yes, I have. We featured that in a top five.
It's absolutely unbelievable to this day.
It's like Future Sex Love Sounds before Future Sex Love Sounds happened.
That's a good way of putting it. It sounds like a car alarm on fire.
Yeah, I think it would be top of the charts today.
It's fucking amazing.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Black Sweat, everybody. Check it out.
Do check out Black Sweat by Prince. Check out most stuff, but not most of it. Check out the good stuff by Prince. I did say, though, you know, all news is local. That is a truism in journalism, you know?
Every day's a school day for me.
You never heard that phrase?
What
do you think it means?
It's relevant to where you are, right?
Correct. You find the angle, you know, like...
You can relate it back.
Is there an Irish angle on this international story, you know, like for an Irish publication? And so on and so forth. All news is local. What is relevant to me? You know, who am I in this? Where am I? You know? And these are the kind of questions, the big questions that some artists ask, you know, like, I mean, like the real thinkers, you know, the real challengers, the doers. I'm doing one of those ads now, you know, an ad for like, you know, Guinness, where it's like, you know, the rebels, you know.
Yeah, Bank of Ireland.
Yeah, the music.
The thinkers.
The music makers, you know.
The mortgage drawdowners.
Fucking awful. The bailouts. But no, here's the thing, right? There are like, you talk about Prince.
Yeah.
You talk about your Princes, you talk about your Madonnas, you talk about these generational, iconoclastic, anti-establishment, just like forces of something, you know, something bigger than ourselves. And not only that, but like, it's not just in the personality that they exude on a daily basis, you know, that they can't turn it off, these people. It's about the art that they create, you know?
Yeah, I feel like you have someone specific in mind that, you know, is on par with Prince, or maybe even slightly more magnanimous.
Yeah, a level beyond, you know, a new level of all of that. And that's our number one. In the bizarre music controversies, this brave, like, really, like, just, like I say, I mean, like, you know, you remember where you were, you know, when you first heard this song and what it said and how it said it. And so, I'm getting a bit emotional here. I don't want to talk too much about it. It's a very personal thing. Let's just take a listen to it. We were walked by the Christian brothers in the cell blocks at our schools. Get a handprint on your skin from a claw of jewels. Go hit me now that I'm twice your size.
That was every song from 2004, everybody. Every single one. They all sounded like that. No, who was that?
It was every emotion from 2004. Yeah. Well, it was Brian McFadden.
Yeah, it sure was.
Yeah, and the song is called Irish Sun.
Yeah, and tell me what it's about, because I had no idea what this was about until this week. I had no idea this happened.
You'd never heard that before?
I'd never heard the song, and I never heard like the reason why this is now our number one.
So, yeah, like, it's a wonderful thing, you know, I mean, to be alive, you know, in this, you know, to have experienced this, really. And like, yeah, I guess, yeah, this song is almost 20 years old. I mean, like, you know, we need to do something to honour this. So as we all know, Brian McFadden was too hot for Westlife and, you know, had to leave eventually. Yeah. You know? And, you know, not invited into the reunions in recent years, which, you know, probably tells his own story. But he was a bad boy. You know, he was the bad boy of the boy band, the Irish boy band, the Irish Son, of course, that he would go on to be.
Yeah.
And he went solo. You know, he did the Robbie Williams thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he split off, he kind of mussed up his hair. You know, he started dressing like a bit of a rock star, some bootcut jeans, that kind of thing. And, you know, convinced...
All rock stars wear bootcut jeans, we all know.
Convinced us all, you know, he had that song Real to Me, you know. That's what's real to me.
I do remember that.
You know, then I throw my finger and watch football on TV. Like, he made, like, really important songs that we still, you know, harken back to today, whether we know it or not. But, you know, he had the song Irish Sun. You might have heard a lyric there, you know, that says, you know, they were warped by the Christian Brothers. So he's referring to his traumatic Christian Brothers education past and how he was apparently on the receiving end of many a beating. You know, presumably because he was so insubordinate and couldn't be tamed. So I'm just going to read now from a Sunday Independent article on Halloween in 2004, right? It says here, the Christian Brothers are to launch an investigation into pop singer Brian McFadden's claims in a new song, Irish Sun, which suggested he was, quote, warped and beaten while at school. Critics have dismissed...
The cell blocks, by the way. Cell blocks.
That's right. And now, let's not paint a wholesome picture of Catholic Ireland schooling, because there was lots of bad shit going on, as we all know.
Jesus.
Including beatings. Critics have dismissed Brian McFadden's new single, in which he recalls a grim childhood of beatings and oppressive Catholic dogma. The 24-year-old singer was just a toddler when corporal punishment was abolished in schools in 1982, yet his song focuses on alleged physical abuse at the hands of the Christian Brothers. A spokesperson for the religious order told the Sunday Independent, and I quote, we were going to let it go, but he came out in a very self-piteous way, and we thought, okay, we're going to check you out. Hell of a quote. We are specifically interested in the facts about his direct contact with the Christian Brothers. We're going to find out how many he had actual contact with in primary school and in secondary school, which he attended for just 1 year. It is our belief that the number was infinitesimally, how do you pronounce this word? Infinitesimally low, and the vast majority of his contact was with lay teachers, non-Christian brothers. So the singer, Brian McFadden, was accused of others of, quote, jumping on a bandwagon of pain, after suggesting he was abused in school by the much maligned order. The much maligned order. That's a weird way of putting it. Like,
yeah.
Like a misfiring striker at a football club, you know? You know, so yeah, the cell blocks thing. Go on, hit me now that I'm twice your size. Hell of a line, by the way. We brushed off the accusations and bowed before your lies. So yeah, like I say, trust me, this is not me going to bat for the Christian Brothers or Irish education in general, especially at that time. There was horrific shit happening. And, you know, it says corporal punishment was abolished in 1982. There was definitely schools where, you know, students are still being hit long after that. But it just came across very sus, you know? People were like, did this happen to you? Like, can you back this up? Like, it's a pretty bad thing when, like, people are like, okay, listen, especially when, like, you know, the Christian Brothers are like, all right, prove it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And also, like, for this song, like, really, Brian, like, this is where you're fucking going with this?
Gee, like, I just think it's really pitiful to hitch your horse to a wagon of pain and suffering that other people have actually fucking endured.
That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, which is...
It's sickening. Like, it's completely despicable. Like, and I'm fucking glad someone held him to account.
There was also, like, in the video, there was, like, a specific school was identified in the music video.
Mm.
And then that school, like, complained and they had to, like, edit it out. You know, because there's a scene where he, like, stops in a taxi and he, like, stares down an old man. It's a hell, it's unbelievable. But they had to, like remove this because it was like, actually, you can't, you know, you're defaming us by putting this in here. So people came out swinging against him, ironically enough. And what else we got here? Great reveal. Oh, yeah, it says, McFadden has admitted blowing nearly all of the $6 million he earned at Westlife on gambling and wild living. On the previous Friday, again, this is back in 2004, he blamed the media for his woes and revealed that the most intimate details of his marriage to Carrie Katona on The Late Late Show. A telling detail here, McFadden's publicist, Max Clifford.
Oh, Christ.
Insisted.
Ding, ding, ding.
Insisted that he stood over the controversial lyrics. What he's written about is his own experience, something he feels very strongly about.
His own experience, yeah, definitely.
His memories of the Christian Brothers are not happy or positive. Quite the opposite, in fact.
What memories?
Rest in,
memories aren't positive at all because they don't exist.
Rest in eternal piss, Max Clifford, by the way.
Yeah, dirtbag.
Fucking scumbag. So there you go. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like rock stars have to do rock star things, Adam. Like, that's just how it goes. But even like, you know, it's, I should say as well that the school that they identified in the video that time, like, Brian McFadden never went there.
Of course, you know? He didn't.
So, like, it's just like, what are we doing? Like, why does this keep happening? But no, he's a great man, isn't he? He's a great musician.
Don't know about that.
Who's definitely, like, never gone on to do other songs of questionable nature. Remember Drunk at the Bar?
Nope.
A really disgusting song.
Yeah, don't want to even.
No, I'm not even going to get into
imagine
it.
Imagine, like, what that's about. Like,
if you look at the lyrics, you'll find out.
No, thank you.
But I will say,
steering well clear of that.
You know, it's, things have dropped off from in recent years, of course. You know, like, who knows what he's doing these days? But it's been.
Are you going to tell us what he's doing these days?
It's been a while, actually, since it was in May. It was in May of 2017. In May of 2017, that this brave man, this big man,
yeah,
this tough boy,
hope you have a quote,
took to Twitter.
Yes.
Right. And he said,
yes,
quote, as we all know,
yeah, yeah,
as we all should know, wouldn't it be great if ISIS had the balls to stand face to face with us and fight? No weapons, no bombs, no dead children, man to man. Yeah.
Man to man.
And in fairness,
this man single-handedly wanted to take on ISIS.
Who backed down. They never took him up on his offer.
No.
So there we go. Let's have one last clip. One we've played in the show before some time ago, but always fun to hear it again. Remember, he teamed up with your favourite human being?
Oh yeah, Keith Duffy.
That's right.
How Are You Duffies?
Keith Duffy.
His fan base, famously called How Are You Duffy, the How Are You Buddies.
That's correct, yes. Keith Duffy, living legend, and Brian McFadden, less so. Of course, I don't know if it's still active, but they did their own little kind of two-man show.
Yeah, and it's called Boys Life.
That's correct. It is called Boys Life.
For those of you who don't know, it's an amalgamation of Boyzone and Westlife.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes couldn't put that one
together. I'm telling you, mind blown. The most thoughtful, inventive stuff I've ever heard in my life.
And that's before you even get to the music. But like, so here they are on the Late Late Show, because not everyone was happy with this union. And let's hear what the boys had to say.
What about Keane today? Yeah, Keane Egan was saying that he said, a member of Westlife who left the band after 4 years decides to use half the name for whatever it is they're doing. I certainly was scratching my head when I saw that version.
A saucer of milk for Keane, please. Well, I was actually in Westlife for a lot longer than 4 years, but Matt's was never Keane's thing, in fairness. You know what? It's saucer milk for Brian. You know what it's like. You know, he's probably on radio, people asking about it. I think a lot of people probably did get confused because some people did report that, like, we were doing a MacBuster, as you said. Yeah, yeah. But
it was different. You know, no, this was from this morning, so he knows what you're doing. He said, from the perspective of someone who spent 15 years in Westlife, it was really aggravating and it was really unfair on the fans.
How is it unfair on the fans?
You know, well, that's what he thinks.
Well, look, listen, at the end of the day, myself and Brian are after teaming up to do a show to entertain people, to talk about 20 years of being in the business
regardless
and have a good time.
Regardless of what
everyone
else thinks.
You know,
I always adore the late clips when they just get cut off abruptly.
Absolutely, like fucking record scratch.
And it could be like something that, like, really horrible. It could be like, you know, and that's when she took the gun out and killed all of those people. It's just like, why? Like, it's so weird. Anyway, listen. Life, love, Brian McFadden. And that's her number one. Don't go after the Christian Brothers, Brian. Better yet, don't make any music ever again.
Don't fucking, like, make it up, though. Don't, like, make shit like that.
Look, it's one man's opinion. It's one man's story.
Dear Lord. You know? Like, what a sad little life, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
No, not great. Not great.
Not great.
No.
Hell of a song, though.
Pro Keith Duffy podcast. Anti-Brian McFadden.
I mean, in fairness, like, I do think Keith Duffy does have a charm.
Oh, yeah, massively. I buy tires from his business all the time.
Do you actually?
I genuinely do.
Well, then he needs to give us something back.
I was there, like, a week and a half ago.
Was he there?
No, he wasn't. There was a big van with his face on it, but...
I want Mr. Duffy to change these tires for me. He's welcome.
Post-haste.
He's welcome on the show anytime.
Anytime.
Genuinely, yeah. I'd actually love to interview him. I'd say it'd be a fun time.
Yeah.
I hope this was a fun time for you, listener. And if you love the show, please tell a friend. That would be good. We'd love if you would spread the word about this little podcast that could. And it's patreon.com/noencore if you want to help support the show. He's neither bizarre nor controversial. He is Sonic Architect Adam.
Hey, and likewise, Dave.
No, I'm bizarre. Very controversial.
Sometimes controversial.
On occasion.
that was fun. Aside from the horrid Brian McFadden stuff, but
you're going to listen to that song every day.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to ever touch that again. I don't think I've ever willingly listened to solo Brian McFadden music.
It's the city that made him. I don't care.
I don't care. It's the fucking just like leave it be, Brian. Leave it be.
That's fair. We're going to leave this be. It's time to go, everybody. It's time to say goodbye on No Encore for this week. My name is Dave Hattenberty. This has been No Encore. This has been a viral infection. Yeah. There will be No Encore, and there will hopefully be the clearance of this viral infection in the weeks to come. Bye-bye. Much love. Take care.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.